Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and happy Constitution Day, happy Constitution Week. Here's, there's some really important things we're actually going to be covering here. But what we want you to do is we want you to understand as we go through this. And as a matter of fact, we hope that you actually pick up the Constitution and read this yourself. Because ignorance is bliss, but understanding the Constitution and becoming literate will help you understand what we have to do with Republic Review and why we have to do this. Because when you start realizing that this is a power of attorney, this is a limited and defined power of attorney that the states created in creating the federal government and delegating powers to what they call this general government. So with that, let's just kind of move forward. Actually, before we even move forward, I want you to understand the circumstances that kind of led up to the Constitution. I cannot emphasize enough that the Articles of Confederation were so failed that the states were literally withering and dying on the vine. There were some states that were doing good, but they were withering, or the Union, actually. Let's see. The Articles of Confederation and the Continental Congress, the government that was created, was dying on the vine. It was being starved because the states refused to feed it. The states took care of themselves, and as a matter of fact, in some ways, some states were working together and creating their own trade agreements outside of the national government. Even though the national government was supposed to have these things, they didn't have the ability to enforce their own laws and their own powers. And even the federal government today does not have the power to enforce it. No, it doesn't have the power to enforce it by itself. Let me be clear. They can call upon the militia, federalize them, and then use them as the enforcement entity. Now, when we look at this Constitution and we look at how the states were the problem, when these men went into Annapolis before they actually convened this convention in Philadelphia in May of 1787, what they were looking at was they were looking at the states themselves being the culprits. So when they got to Pennsylvania, they all had to have a very honest and forthright discussion regarding what the real problem was. They could not, by good conscience, not allow the government to be reformed and re-energized with the appropriate powers. And in essence, creating a new government, they had to do this because at that point in time, they saw France, they saw Britain, and they saw all of the other world powers that they owed money to getting very anxious with the fact that they're not getting paid. And things were getting worse. As a matter of fact, it was very clear. Many people saw the doom and the destruction of the Union because of the Articles of Confederation. So when they went into the secret meeting in 1787, I think it was March 27th, 25th, off the top of my head, I don't remember the specific day, but I do remember that was March, it was May. And in May, when they actually had this very specific meeting, they wanted to make sure that they didn't play their hands out in the public, that nobody would speak to reporters or anybody else about what they were doing. It was kind of like swearing everybody to secrecy because they wanted to finish without being harassed, without being harangued regarding what they were doing. And when you think about it, the duration of time that they took and what they were supposed to do, you would have thought that the states would have said, hey, aren't you guys done by now? Because the states really wanted to constrain the federal government. They did not want these men to be able to actually, rewrite the Constitution. However, when it came down to it, when you looked at their commission was to suggest anything that would, you know, fix their problems. So when you really look at the commission, you look at what they were doing, a lot of people, and there's the John Birch Society that says this was a runaway convention. I'm telling you, it wasn't. These men had to apply their fundamental rights as Englishmen, actually as Americans, because you got to understand, all these men were Englishmen until this United States stood up, and they had these rights, inalienable rights, that were declared underneath the Declaration of Independence. And when government, through train, you know, all these abuses, we have a right, and they extended their right of altering the government instead of abolishing it. And so what they did was they provided an alternate government. One of the things you have to also look at, and I would encourage anybody to go to the Federalist Papers, I think it's around 38 to 43, somewhere in there, where you'll find Madison is actually going through how they duplicated almost word for word the usage and the verbiage that they had in the Articles of Confederation into some of the articles. So anyway, what we want to do is we want you to kind of realize that when this thing was written and when it was read for the first time, many people looked at, you know, this Constitution as a new government. They looked at this as a paradigm shift. And many people had a hard time understanding why were some of the things that they injected into this actually in this. So, as we kind of say and we do the obligatories every day, this show was also sponsored by RepublicReview.org, and you are listening to the only show that provides you the academic evidence and the academic evidence-based solutions. We would like to point you to TimberNation.com for your hardwood furnishing needs and radio dust covers for protecting that valuable electronic gear that you may have. And add local to where you can get ISP services, infrastructure services, and those types of things for your internet, your domain, emailing, that type of stuff. We would like to remind you that your state legislators are invited to participate at no cost Red Pill Expo this coming November. So they have fundamentally a free admission. All they have to do is just show up with their ID, or actually I think they can register, and we'll provide this information. We'll put it up online, and hopefully it'll be up on Red Pill Expo as well. We need to get businesses involved. We need to get them to understand, you know, why they have to start spending money for constitutional warriors to become public servants. Our comment line, 425-270-5416. And with that, as we've kind of cleared out the obligatories, let me go down this path of kind of giving you what we've got to start off with on the Constitution. Some people know what a preamble is, and the preamble is what you actually read at the very top. But interestingly enough, it doesn't say preamble up there. When one looks at the Constitution, when one actually sees the picture, they see, "We the people." Well, that's a part of the preamble. So what's a preamble? By definition, a preamble is a preliminary statement. It is the introduction to a formal document that explains its purpose, kind of like a preface. A statement accompanying a law or regulation specifying its purpose or reason for enactment. Now, why did GR just read that? Because there are actually two preambles in the Constitution. The very first one, which again isn't labeled by preamble, and the beginning of Section 8 of Article 1. Right at the very beginning of Section 8 of Article 1, you'll find that there's a preamble that actually kind of makes this statement of the intent of the following powers. It is not a clause of delegating powers. It is a preamble to it. And so the framers clarified that that was a preamble, that it was granting no powers specifically. So today we actually see justices and other people pointing to that and saying, hey, that's actually a power. It's giving us general powers. No, This is why definitizing and canonizing the Constitution is critical. Because once we've canonized it or definitized it, then everybody that reads this, it will actually have a clarification that says this is a preamble and point to the references in the ratification debates as to how they were asserting and acclaiming that this truly is a preamble in Section 8 of Article 1. So with that, and with a little swig of water, let's start off. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic, or now they're actually writing with ensure, I-N-S-U-R-E, domestic tranquility. Now, technically, ensure, that word itself means to underwrite, like insurance, to kind of protect with underwriting a financial, protection of something. That word probably should be EN, ensure, because it doesn't make sense of financially underwriting the domestic tranquility. So anyway, to establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, and promote the general welfare. And I don't want to even glaze over this, so we will get back to the preamble. When we get back, we'll just start. It's really just a long run-on sentence, but we'll get back to it when we come back from these two promos. Thank you so much. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so the preamble. Let's start off again. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Nice words, right? But none of this is granting any power. It is basically explaining what they're trying to do in this, to provide for the common defense and promote the general welfare, promote, you know, good things that the states would be able to thrive on their own, not to you know, hey, have a deep, you know, treasury account so they could just pay everybody constantly. That was never the intent. So Article 1 is the very first article that kind of lays out some structure and defines the Congress. Article 1 literally just deals with the legislative branch of Congress, and there are two sides to it. There is the House of Representatives and there is the Senate, and combined they are called Congress. Section 1, right out the gate, the very first line in the Constitution is being violated, and we see it being violated left and right today. And it says right here in Section 1, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives. How is this being violated? When a president uses executive orders to create law and to, you know, dictate to the states or what have you that they have to do something, he is exercising legislative powers, because legislative is just that, creating law, writing law. Well, the justices do this too with their rulings. They can't create law with their rulings. Their rulings have to be, yes, this is within the Constitution, it isn't within the Constitution. They do not have the ability to actually legislate and make something law. When they rule on a case, that is it. It only settles that case. It does not settle law. And furthermore, the jurisdiction, this is why we read the ratification debates earlier this year, the jurisdiction of the federal government is limited. It is specifically limited to the enumerated powers. So if they're talking about marriage, then marriage has no, they have no jurisdiction because it's not enumerated. When they get into, you know, protection under the law, equal protection under the law, they do not have the ability to use that into expanding their reach into all of these different aspects. That is very specific, equal protection under the law, under those things that they have the legal power to legislate over. Again, the enumerated powers. So when they start talking about, oh, well, equal protection, they, you know, there was the Equal Protection Clause. No, equal protection is a clause that only applies to the enumerated powers. That's it. It's just the same thing as the Commerce Clause or the General Welfare Clause or the Supremacy or Necessary and Proper Clauses. Those both are limited to the enumerated powers. Madison said this very clearly in the ratification debates, as well as a president when he vetoed the Departments of Transportation, or the attempt in creating the footings for the Department of Transportation. Section 2, the House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the United States. So forgive me, my tongue is still kind of kinked and twisted because of the medication withdrawals and so forth. I've said this before. I was put on steroids for 3 months to really help clear up my lungs and the inflammation, so that we could figure out, you know, just how bad the damage is to my lungs. And so, anyway, I'm struggling here. So just bear with me and please give me some forbearance and some forgiveness and you know, patience. There we go. So, Section 2. The House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. Okay, so there you have it right there. The House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for the electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. No person shall be a representative who shall not have attained to the age of 25 years and been 7 years a citizen of the United States. Now, what did I just say? I just said something that's interesting. that the qualifications for somebody to become a representative, they have to have attained the age of 25 and they have to have been a citizen of the United States. Now, I understood that this Constitution didn't delineate citizens of the United States, but right there we see it is. Either it is or it isn't. And I'm telling you that the Constitution, when it was ratified, every citizen of every state automatically became a citizen of the United States. And moving on, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of the state in which he shall be chosen? In other words, you have to be an inhabitant of that state of what you're chosen to be as a representative. So, in other words, you can't just move there and then move right out, or you can't run for one state while you're living in a different state. Now, this is the interesting part, because what we're coming up on is something that is being violated. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union, according to the respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. Now, they're talking about indentured servants. Now, they're talking about adding this 3/5 and not including Indians not taxed, because it says excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. So it's kind of interesting how they kind of did the math layout here, because they did this, this, minus this, and this. So you'd think, well, was the minus this and this also a minus? No, actually it was a plus. There's a comma there, but I'm going, why did they do it that way? Should have been plus, 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 minus, and then that would have been cleaner. Anyway, so this was modified by the 14th Amendment, that the enumeration in Section 2 of the 14th Amendment actually clarifies how the apportionment is to be done, and it actually has a stipulation in Section 2 that if anybody is ineligible to vote, then they can't be apportioned for representation, which means illegal aliens, invaders in America, are not allocated or cannot be counted for representation, and they should not have any say in representation because they are not citizens of the United States. Anyway, moving on, this is all still a part of Section 2. The actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of Congress of the United States, and within every subsequent term of 10 years in such manner as shall by law direct. In other words, they're doing consensus. The number of representatives shall not exceed 1 for every 30,000. In other words, there is to be 1 representative for every 30,000 citizens. But each state shall have at least 1 representative, and until such enumeration shall be made, the state of New Hampshire shall be entitled to choose 3, Massachusetts 8, Rhode Island and Providence Plantations 1. That was the name of the state back then. Rhode Island and Providence Plantations 1. Connecticut 5. New York 6. New Jersey 4. Pennsylvania 8. Delaware 1. Maryland 6. Virginia 10. North Carolina 5. And South Carolina 5. And Georgia 3. So, wow, 10, that's a big number, right? Especially when you look at everybody else is getting 5 or what have you. Virginia was the big dog. Anyway, when vacancies happen in the representation from any state, the executive authority thereof shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies. The House of Representatives shall choose their speaker and other officers and shall have the sole power of impeachment. Section 3. Now this goes into the Senate. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of 2 senators from each state, chosen by the legislature thereof for 6 years. Each senator shall have 1 vote. immediately after. Now, interesting that they talk about each senator shall have one vote, but interestingly enough, they didn't mention anything about voting regarding the House of Representatives at this point. Interesting, right? Anywho, the Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators. Each senator shall have one vote. Immediately after, they shall be assembled in consequence of the first election. And this is where they start breaking it up into classes of three. So every 2 years, a new senator, or I should say an election for a senator, in breaking everybody into threes, forces the, or actually ensures that there'll always be some continuity within the Senate. You can't just wholesale change the Senate in one election. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let's kind of go through this. I want to go through this a little bit slowly because this is how they separate the senators into classes. And what I mean by that is like cohorts or groups for their re-election. So some senators that went right in 2 years, they were re-elected for 6 years. And then some other senators, one-third of the other senators that went in, they were re-elected in 4 years. And then the final class of senators, they were elected or went for their re-election in 6 years. This way they spanned it out so that there would never be a time where you could actually replace the entire Senate in one full swoop. Unlike the House of Representatives, we can actually vote them all out in one full swoop. So immediately after they shall be assembled in consequence of the first election, they shall be divided as equally as may be into three classes. The seats of the senator of the first class shall be vacated at the expiration of the second year, of the second class at the expiration of the fourth year, and of the third class at the expiration of the sixth year, so that one-third may be chosen every second year, and if vacancies happen by resignation or otherwise during the recess of the legislature of any state, the executive thereof may make temporary appointments until the next meeting of the legislature, which shall then fill such vacancies. Now, when we go back up to the filling, the executive thereof shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies. the vacancies happening in representation from any state, it doesn't state that he will actually fill the vacancies. So what that means is that he basically will call for writs of election for such vacancies. Does that mean that it goes to, and actually not. What ends up happening with a House of Representatives, the representative that dies or that is been, you know, called and charged with treason and hung or whatever, right? Whatever the circumstances are, there is a vacancy now in that seat. The governor then goes back and does a writ of election. Interesting thing that they do, and just so you understand this, so that they can fill that seat because Congress is no longer a temporary seat and they want to make sure these things get filled. What the governor will do, and this is how it is in Washington State, and I believe it's the same way in every state, that the person that sits in that seat, the party, I should say, of the person that sat in that seat, if it was the Republican Party, then the governor would call upon the Republican parties of the counties that are being represented to have the central committees meet so that they can choose who the selection would be. And usually it's a, you know, number one selection, number two selection, and number three selection. Usually they'll provide three potential replacements. And nine times out of ten, the governor will follow with their first recommendation. The reason they do it this way is because the party has hijacked the process. Instead of allowing the legislative district to have and conduct their own, you know, emergency ballot, they give it to the party. Doesn't that bother you? That for the duration of that term, and it could be, this happened with Trump. Trump pulled out representatives, and we ended up replacing those representatives, you know, by filling those seats with the party. And it's got to bother you if you're not a party member. You're an independent, you're a card carrying independent. In other words, you're not registered as a Democrat or anything else. It should bother you that the selection of who goes to Congress is given to the good old boy club. And when you look at how many people are part of that party, it's not even a majority. There's no way it's a majority. Because the independents are much larger than the Republicans or the Democrats. And in some cases, the independents outweigh both together. Anyway, moving on. No person shall be a senator who shall not have attained the age of 30 years and been 9 years a citizen of the United States. Again, it points to the fact that there is this thing called citizen of the United States within the Constitution, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state for which he shall be chosen. In other words, you have to be a resident. You cannot not be one and represent that state. The Vice President of the United States shall be the President of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided. In other words, he's not a normal voting member, but will cast a vote to break the tie. The Senate shall choose their other officers and also a President pro tempore in the absence of the Vice President, or when he shall exercise the office of President of the United States. So in other words, when the Vice President has to step in and act as the President, then the Senate shall basically choose their President pro tempore, because technically that's the Vice President. But in case the Vice President is unavailable, then they will choose a President pro tempore in his absence. Now, I don't know, do they give the President pro tempore a second vote? Because let's say that he votes or she votes and it ends up in a tie, then they vote again? Kind of interesting. I don't know. Anyway, because that's a technicality. I don't know if we've ever been there. I don't know if that's ever occurred. The Vice President of the United States shall be the President of the Senate and shall vote on when equally done, pro tempore. Okay, so now I'm back on track. The Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. So the House of Representatives have the power of impeachment, the sole power of impeachment, to determine whether somebody should be removed, and then the process goes to trial. The Senate does the trial to determine whether the president is to be removed or not. When sitting for that purpose, they shall be on oath or affirmation. When the president of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside, and no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of two-thirds of the members present. So in other words, you don't have to have the whole Senate there. You just need two-thirds of the members present to get a conviction. Judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal. This is bad English, but back in those days they used it differently. Extend further than the removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States, but the party convicted shall nonetheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to the law. Now, I want you to understand this part of impeachment. When a president is impeached, in other words, when Congress feels that there's enough evidence to find the president guilty of violating the Constitution, violating his oath of office, committing high crimes, misdemeanors, what have you, right? Then the Senate will try him to determine whether he's been guilty of this. But the whole intent behind the judgment of impeachment shall not extend further than the removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor. This is why I am telling you, my friends, that a former president can be impeached for the deeds done while he was in presidency. Let's say we find out that a president did bad things like Clinton, like Obama, while they were in office. We never impeached them. That doesn't mean that these men can't be impeached, like Bush, like Carter. These men are all susceptible to being impeached. Why? Because it is a removal from office. Well, back in those days, when you left office as president, your emolument stopped, everything stopped. You no longer had any position. You were basically public Joe citizen number one, number two, number three, number four, however many people are on your block. Bottom line, today you have a president that maintains a permanent salary, maintains an office, and maintains security, maintains access to government, all of these things as they have beefed up the privileges of the elite, of the presidents and elected officials and so forth. They've given themselves further emoluments. Then those things are what can be removed. In other words, Obama and Clinton can pay for their own detail of security if they want security. They'll have to get their own jobs because we, the people, do not owe them. But see, when they started creating these lifetime benefits for presidents and so forth, that they should have changed the impeachment process to include the ability to remove them from these things. Because I'm telling you, they have no problem coming after a vet that has got his retirement. They'll come and court-martial you. They'll come and pull you in and try to judge you for something that you did well after, not having anything to do with your service. But this has everything to do with their service or what they're doing as a former president, the office of former president. Anyway, okay, so Section 4. We're going into Section 4, and we're going into a break, and these two trains are colliding as we watch. So, anyway, we'll have to find out who loses, who wins in the collision, but we're going into Section 4 of Article 1. We're not even halfway through, my friends, because there are 10 sections to Article 1. It'll probably take a couple days, but this is interesting because this is where we talk about electors and so forth. We'll be right back after this.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and their 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as we were just interrupted going into Section 4, let's start off with Section 4. That seems like a logical place to go. And actually, I hope as things have progressed this week, I've gone from really bad to thinking I was going to die just because I had no energy to the end of the week, at least having some moderate energy. So I believe next week I should be a little bit sharper, maybe not as sharp as a tack, but sharp enough to hopefully penetrate your hearts and minds regarding the Constitution as we read through this. But anyway, just figured I'd give you a heads up or, you know, let you know things are getting a little better because I try not to linger too much on that type of stuff. Anyway, Section 4. The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the state legislature thereof, but the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations, except as to the places of choosing senators. Interesting. So, as you understand, this is one thing that has really been, you know, violated because, especially this last year, we saw how legislatures were not the ones able to make making the manner of choosing electors or the election itself. That was all being changed by governors and judges. This is why we have that petition. I got to remember at the beginning of each of these shows, go take a look at that petition. Get it going. I got to get the signatures up. As soon as I have the signatures up, I will unleash the hounds. So anyway, most people should be able to just move forward with the petition. There will be minor alterations, if at all. Anyway, let's move forward. The Congress shall assemble at least once in every year, and such meeting shall be on the first Monday in December. Interesting. Modified by the 20th Amendment, unless they shall by law appoint a different day. So what does the 20th Amendment state? Here we go. Okay, so Section 1, the terms of the president shall end, and the Congress shall be assembled at least once a year. So it's Section 2 of the 20th Amendment. The Congress shall assemble at least once in every year, and such meeting shall begin at noon on the third day of January, unless they shall by law appoint a different day. Okay, so what that means is that this past January, on the 3rd, when Bob and company went in to petition Congress to do their job on the 4th and received receipt, that means that all of Congress was there. Do you get that? So they received that petition, and it stands to reason why they should actually be sued. Anyway, Section 5. Each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members, and a majority of each shall constitute a quorum to do business. Now, each house shall be the judge of elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members. Now, what I want you to understand here is, where are the judges? Because bottom line, as they look at the electors are a part of this as well. Because the electors and the representatives are the representatives of the people. The electors just have a very specific portion of this. And so we'll get into this a little bit more. But bottom line, on January 6th, Congress should have been the judge of the election, the returns, and qualifications. And oddly enough, anybody that gets elected today, I'm in favor of changing the language of this to moving the confirmation of the election not to be done by Congress or by the individuals, but to be done in concert with the states and the states' audits. I believe every election should be completely audited. We have to start going down the path of saying every election possesses fraud, and until we can do, you know, a 20-year process of electing people without fraud, without any indication, without even a peep that there has been some fraudulent activity. In other words, once we actually become worthy of entering into the promised land, which took 40 days or 40 years, I mean, you know, maybe half that, we should, you know, be able to start not necessarily auditing every year, but auditing. But we still, you got to do a random audit. And I believe that there needs to be a determination as to, you know, okay, this is the year we have to audit because we just randomly selected this year as the year to audit. Nobody knows when that card gets turned and, oh, wow, this is the year we audit the entire election. If you understand the point of this, that means that everybody has to behave, because you have no idea out of a 5-year period or whatever it is that you do this, then everybody will go, you know what, we can't afford to get caught because that card may turn. I understand that there are cheaters and there are all sorts of ways that people will want to cheat. I get it. That's the nature of man in cheating. However, I think we can come up with a process in a way that eliminates their ability to cheat and or undermine the election process. Anyway, back to Section 5. So each house, the House of Representatives and the Senate, shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members. Now, here's the problem. Where does this fit in with Section 3 of the 14th Amendment? With the majority of each shall constitute a quorum to do business, but a smaller number may adjourn from day to day and be authorized to compel the attendance of absent members in such manner and under such penalties as each house may provide. Each house may determine the rules of its proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and, with the concurrence of 2/3, expel a member. You know, McCain, some of these guys, they should have actually been expelled. And I honestly believe that the party should have more pull and more say in this as well. As much as I want to excoriate the party, I believe that if the Constitution Party becomes a party of the Constitution, in other words, no political agenda, it is not a political party. It is all about the Constitution, because the Constitution is not political. You either comply to it or you don't comply to it. So making the Constitution Party apolitical and all about enforcement and compliance, then I would love to see the Constitution Party start stepping forward and excommunicating or expelling these members out of Congress for their, you know, nefarious deeds or what have you. Each house shall keep a journal of its proceedings and from time to time publish the same. This is how we got the Congressional Globe, the Annals of Congress, and the, I think it's the History of Congress, or maybe it's the Congressional Record now. Anyway, there's three separate documents, and the Annals of Congress was the first, and then they switched over to the Congressional Globe, which is at the Library of Congress. This is where GR gets a lot of his meat and information. Accepting such parts as may be their judgment require secrecy, and the yeas and nays of the members of either house on any shall, at the desire of one of those of the desire of one fifth of those present, be entered into the journal. Now, what I'd like to see, this amended. Now, once the states kind of take back with Republic Review, I believe that there's merit in actually reading in state legislatures into clearances so that everything that they do, even if they mark it for secrecy, the state legislators should be able to see what it is that they are writing, they're doing, and everything else. They should be able to go in just for the purpose of oversight. So I need to add that in there because we need oversight by the by the state legislatures, right? So you hear GR typing. And so, yep, that's what we're doing. All right. So I think that's a brilliant idea because bottom line, with Snowden, I'll go back to Snowden. Had Snowden had the ability to go into any state legislature, such as Hawaii, and I said, I need to speak to the state the few state legislators who are cleared to do intelligence oversight, keeping everything tucked away until those people come in and they bring him into a skiff, you know, not knowing what he has or anything else, so that he can actually show them exactly what the federal government was doing, why they were doing this. And see, the process, I've talked about this before, the process should be this, that the state legislators, they don't contact the federal government first. The first thing they do is they take video camera, you know, coverage, they take images, copies, and everything else, and they send this to all the other skiffs within the other 49 states. So every state now is informed of what the federal government has been whistleblown on regarding intelligence. This is how you get all 50 states to then step in. This is how, you know, somebody, when they're involved in the intelligence community, doesn't go out to the press like Snowden does and aggrandize himself for popularity and become some, you know, some rock star who's really just a trollop trying to get his day in fame, you know, his 15 minutes of fame. Anyway, so as you can tell, I ran out of time because I kind of went down this path of oversight and intelligence oversight. We will be back and we will continue with Section 5 of Article 1 in our next episode. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.